From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida House is trying again to lower the minimum age for buying long guns.
We talk about rights, and we kind of gloss over the rights of the 14 teenagers who never graduated high school.
Also this week, if students aren't signing up for certain courses, why should colleges and universities keep those courses in the catalog?
We're going to stop enrolling students in the program, take a hard look at the program, and either decide to update the curriculum, revise the curriculum, or decide to terminate the program.
We'll also talk with a noted attorney regarding the latest Epstein Files revelations and do a deep dive into the factors making Florida less and less affordable. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The Florida House is again considering a controversial bill that would lower the minimum age to purchase rifles and other long guns from 21 to 18. A House panel approved the bill this week along party lines, as we hear from Gina Jordan.
The proposal would reverse a decision made by the Florida legislature and then Governor Rick Scott after the mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
This is always deeply personal to me since I served as the mayor of Parkland when we had the shooting in 2018.
Parkland Democratic Representative Christine Hunchovsky choked up as she remembered the day that Nicholas Cruz opened fire inside the school, killing 17 students and staff members and wounding 17 more.
And it gets harder when we talk about rights and we kind of gloss over the rights of the 14 teenagers who never graduated high school.
I happen to believe that the correct public policy is to allow individuals over the age of 18 to exercise their right to keep and bear arms to protect themselves and their families.
The House Criminal Justice Subcommittee voted 11-5 along party lines to approve the bill, sponsored by House Majority Leader Tyler Saroy of Merritt Island. For 3 years in a row, the Florida House has passed bills to undo the 2018 law, but the Senate has not gone along. This is the fourth try, and Weston Democratic Representative Robin Bartleman says every attempt opens the wounds of Parkland survivors and loved ones.
They make the journey to come up here. They send us letters and tell us, please, do not undo this bill. Every year, you don't have a Senate companion. Every year, the parents are brought to tears.
Senate President Ben Albritton has not taken a stance on the issue, but the proposal would have to go through the Senate Rules Committee, where Chairwoman Kathleen Passidomo has said she will not roll back the 2018 law. Jacksonville Republican Representative Jessica Baker says the law creates an unfair situation, since anyone under 21 cannot buy long guns, but they can receive them as gifts.
If we believe in equality, how is it fair that a young adult from a well-off family can get a long gun as a gift and protect their home and their families, but a young adult with no family support cannot?
It's more of a parenting issue for Hudson Republican Representative Kevin Steele, who recently announced he's running for state chief financial officer. He told the committee his four daughters have long guns and use them.
They've all hunted. From early on, my seven-year-old shot her first buck at seven, right? And so she was taught the responsibility of a firearm, and that was by me. That was not by somebody else. That was not by the internet. But responsibility is a parent's job to teach the children. And I think we're talking about a parental issue, not necessarily a purchase issue.
The National Rifle Association is challenging the constitutionality of the law that raised the purchase age to 21. The group has repeatedly lost and now has an appeal pending at the U.S. Supreme Court. Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer has said he will not defend the law at the nation's high court. I'm Gina Jordan.
State universities and colleges are either cutting or reevaluating out more than two dozen degree programs that officials say are underperforming in the job market. Tristan Wood reports state lawmakers learned about the plan during a recent committee hearing.
Florida's public university system is typically a good return on investment for in-state students, says Emily Sykes, State University System Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs.
And most Florida resident undergraduates finish their degree without taking on any loans, which is opposite of what you're probably seeing in the headlines about more students taking on loans. That's not true in Florida. We actually have 80% of our resident undergrads leave our system without taking out a loan. So that's pretty remarkable.
Sykes says 75% of Florida undergraduate students were in a job paying at least $40,000 annually, or continuing their education a year after graduation. However, the state university system has identified 214 degree programs they say are lacking when it comes to employment opportunities. Those include degrees in cultural and gender studies, some languages, philosophy, religion, and more. And of those the university system identified, colleges have shuttered about 24 of those programs.
With this review, the universities have identified 18 programs to terminate and have identified 8 to suspend. So with the suspension, that means that they've identified they're going to stop enrolling students in the program, take a hard look at the program, and either decide to update the curriculum, revise the curriculum, or decide to terminate the program.
The move comes as the state in recent years under Governor Ron DeSantis and the Republican-controlled legislature has targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, or DEI. Now, some Democrats worry this is the next step of that crackdown.
You're discouraging people from pursuing careers in history, in sociology, in political science.
During the recent committee hearing, St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Michelle Rayner asked for more information about why specific programs were targeted for removal. She says she thinks looking at degrees only as vehicles for earning money ignores the positive impact study in some of those areas could have when it comes to bettering society.
And we're not allowing people to have an understanding of the history of that and how that impacts what we see now and how we are able to potentially maybe rectify those issues.
Those graduating with the most popular undergraduate degree programs like mechanical engineering and computer science are seeing quick returns on investment, though. The median salary 1 year after graduation for students who graduate with one of the top 15 majors is over $50,000 a year. I'm Tristan Wood.
The latest release of Jeffrey Epstein files by Congress suggests that President Donald Trump was aware of the sex crimes committed by the late wealthy financial advisor. It was in Palm Beach County where Epstein carried on a friendship with Trump years before Trump was elected president. Trump says he severed ties with Epstein in the late 2000s. WLRN's Tim Padgett spoke with West Palm Beach attorney Spencer Coovan. He's the chief legal officer at Gold Law and represents a group of Epstein victims.
What, though, are the most troubling questions still unanswered in the Jeffrey Epstein tragedy? Not just questions surrounding his relationship with Donald Trump, but the larger scope and effects of this sex trafficking scandal.
I think at the end of the day, there's been a lot of talk about all of the other individuals that were involved in this, either as complicit participants in the organization or just people that were looking the other way. That discussion, I think, will be solidified. A picture paints 1,000 words, but videotape paints 1,000,000.
What are the materials that would be most important in pushing the Epstein case forward? And I mean forward in the way that so many in the U.S. are clamoring to see it pushed forward, including, we have to point out, people in Donald Trump's very own political base.
The criminal prosecution for Epstein and Maxwell is effectively over. But they were never operating the scheme in a vacuum. There were numerous individuals that were assisting in the operation of this sex trafficking scheme throughout the country and throughout the world. He was operating here in the United States. He was operating in the Virgin Islands. He was operating over in Paris where he had a home. And at the end of the day, the victims really want exposure for this story so that the world can see that this type of a crime occurs not in a vacuum and not to just people that live in a bad area or bad neighborhood. These were wealthy, powerful individuals that span the globe that were doing this, and they need the world to see the truth of what happened to them so that hopefully it never happens again.
Right. And particularly since, well, you know, here in South Florida, we have seen other cases like this in the news in the past year or two. Spencer, you're particularly familiar with much of the evidentiary material involved in the Epstein case or cases from years back. But we have to keep in mind that we're dealing with two types of evidentiary material here, criminal and civil, which carry different standards of proof. How will those differences play out in terms of what Epstein material the public will eventually see and how they see it?
Well, I think we've already seen the edges of that so far when the Justice Department talks about disclosure of information. They have said that they have disclosed all information and prosecuted all individuals that they feel could be prosecutable. But if we're going to have people in power in the United States, whether it be political power or financial power, then the public needs to know who they are and what they've done, regardless of whether it's prosecutable or not. You know, my clients don't care about party or politics. They don't care. Every person with meaningful ties to Epstein should be disclosed and fully scrutinized by the public.
That was West Palm Beach attorney Spencer Coovin speaking with WLRN's Tim Padgett. It's getting harder to get by financially in the state of Florida. Despite the minimum wage rising to $14 an hour, that amount is not enough to get by, according to the Florida Policy Institute. The Institute says the average wage should be closer to $18 an hour for a single adult. For anyone with a child, it should be more than $27 per hour for a single parent. WGCU's Sandra Victorova recently spoke with the Institute's senior policy analyst, Alexis Soukalos, to learn why Floridians should be concerned.
Just step back and talk about what we mean when we say living wage. Obviously, there's specific data points that went into that, including childcare, housing, and food. But generally, a living wage is meant to be more than a bare subsistence wage. It doesn't include emergency funds or savings, but includes enough that you're not going to be housing or food insecure for the most part. What a living wage is obviously depends on where you live and the cost of living.
Sure.
I'll say nationwide, advocates have pushed for a $17 minimum wage as a living wage standard. Now imagine if you do have one child, two children, three children, it's going to get, of course, much more expensive for you.
How many people in our area are not making a living wage?
Well, in Florida in general, so there's at least 1.2 million people who are making less than a $15 minimum wage, which we know is still not living wage in many places. And as far as who was going to benefit most directly from this $14 bump, we know in Florida that's over 800,000 people. That's a significant number. When you look at Southwest Florida in particular, Lee, Collier, and Charlotte counties, for example, for most of them, at least 10% of their workforce was making less than $14 an hour before it went up September 30th. So, you know, it's a significant number of people.
Why should people care about this issue? If somebody's earning a lot more than minimum wage and they're doing fine, is there really any impact to those who are not struggling?
There are huge societal implications. When you start to pay people better, they're able to spend more. They have more money in their pockets. So that's spending power. That's going back into the economy. They're less likely to be reliant on the social safety net, things like SNAP and TANF, for long and extended periods of time. They're more likely to be able to afford health care. Ultimately, when people cannot afford basic living standards, it might not show up right away, but it has this ripple effect and it starts to depress communities and depress the state economy. The other thing is that I don't think a lot of people realize when you actually raise the minimum wage of your workforce, what often happens is employers then give their more senior workers or those who have higher pay a little bit of a bump because they don't want it to be where, oh, I'm 2 years ahead of you or I've been in this job longer and now I'm making the same as this person making minimum wage. So there is a benefit directly for those who are not earning the minimum wage too.
Dr. Soukalos, Florida has the highest minimum wage in the South, but you would say that really doesn't resolve the issue.
Right, because it's easy to look at a number objectively and say, oh, wow, $15, which is where we'll be next year. That's a lot. That's why we did this dashboard, to show you when you're actually comparing to how high the cost of living has gotten everywhere, especially in Florida, it really is not a significant number. And the other thing I would like to point out is the reason that Florida has this higher minimum wage is because of voters themselves. It's because of the public themselves. Twice now, minimum wage has been put on our ballot, and voters, more than 60% of them, said every time, this is across party lines, gender, ethnicity, we want to get paid more. So this is definitely something the public wants, and the state and its leaders need to make sure that they don't undercut that and bolster it with other policies to help people afford basic way of life.
That was Florida Policy Institute Senior Policy Analyst Alexis Tsoukalos with WGCU's Sandra Victorova. People who buy their health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace are getting sticker shock. The federal government is slashing subsidies for Obamacare health plans, and monthly costs for insurance are skyrocketing. WUSF's Kerry Sheridan reports on the tough decisions some Floridians are making.
Celeste Jamison is 41 and lives in Northport. She says in her teens and 20s,
I was in and out of hospitals with severe pain, ovarian contusions and everything, and with no insurance.
The bills piled up. She got into medical debt. The pain in her abdomen kept getting worse. Finally, she got health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace in 2014.
I mean, truly, it was a lifesaver for me because in May of 2014, again, I had to be rushed to the emergency room. It was probably like the worst pain I had ever had. And one of the doctors were just like, well, let's do exploratory surgery. Let's find out what's going on. And then that month, I was diagnosed with endometriosis.
It's a condition about 1 in 10 women have, where tissue similar to the lining of the uterus grows in other parts of the body. And it took surgery to figure it out. Once she felt better, she was able to take on regular work as a paralegal. At first, Jamison paid about $25 a month for insurance. It went up every year. Right now, she pays $266 a month. Next year, it's more than double.
I can't afford $593 a month. I just can't, on top of all of my other living expenses.
A lot of people are in the same boat because enhanced federal subsidies from the pandemic are ending. Jack Roken is a health insurance broker in Hallandale Beach.
The problem is, in the younger generation, because the price has gone up, it's going to cause people to get out of the insurance pool. That's called a death spiral in the industry.
To make up for those losses, insurance carriers have to raise rates.
That's the double whammy effect. The subsidies go down, people leave, and then suddenly the prices for those remaining go up dramatically.
Florida is getting hit hard by all this. For one, it never expanded Medicaid, and it's a big state with the largest percentage of people in the nation getting insurance from the ACA marketplace. Many are professionals working at jobs that don't provide health coverage. Jason Lego is 39 and a psychiatric mental health nurse in St. Petersburg.
At this point, basically, I'm looking at getting some kind of like catastrophic insurance coverage, if that's even possible.
His husband is a kayaking tour guide in Shell Key. They're both in good health. Lago's income rose last year, so their insurance is now going from $143 a month to more than $1,200 a month.
I'm more than willing to pay my share of whatever I have to, but $1,200 a month is, in my mind, extremely unreasonable, and I don't think I'll even need a portion of that.
It's not an easy decision, especially for those with health issues. Shane Bonner is 33 and works as a server in Orlando. He recently found out several people in his family have a genetic heart condition.
And then I've just started to, this year, have symptoms as well. Led me to go to the emergency room already once, and they were able to tell me that I need to see a cardiologist, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to do that without healthcare.
For him, the cost is going up by several hundred dollars each month, and his plan has a high deductible, so the first $8,000 in healthcare charges come straight out of his pocket.
I understand, again, that the Affordable Care Act may not be the best thing in the world, but not having anything in place for people on the back end is what's really scary to me.
Like others interviewed for this story, Bonner would like to see some form of universal health care that's affordable and covers everyone. Now that the government shutdown is over, with no concessions on health care, which Democrats wanted, Bonner says he feels let down.
I feel like that's the biggest takeaway from all of this is I don't feel like I have any representation.
It's unclear if lawmakers will extend the subsidies. The deadline for most plans on the ACA marketplace is just a month away. I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
Studying dementia presents a lot of challenges for researchers. Observing complex mechanisms in the brain as they naturally occur is next to impossible without invasive measures like a spinal tap. But researchers at the University of Central Florida have found a way to study dementia using the saliva of patients before and after they listened to music they grew up on. Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pettersson tells us UCF neurologists and musicians are working together on a novel musical way to better understand brain wellness.
That's the sound of the Pegasus String Quartet, made up of three graduate students and a professor from UCF's School of Performing Arts. The musicians are rehearsing for their upcoming performance on Friday, the second of three concerts that are part of a first-time collaboration with the neurology department. In the audience will be healthy patients and patients of varying degrees of dementia. The idea here is to collect their saliva before and after the performance to track their brain's response to the music.
If we can improve their brain function by the music, that'd be great.
That's Dr. Kiminobu Sagaya, head of UCF's neuroscience department. He's also one of the researchers who developed this new kind of test, allowing scientists to use saliva to better understand dementia. Sagaya says cells carrying biomarkers are found in saliva, and those biomarkers show what neurons are saying to each other, in this case, when music is playing.
They're using this transmitter to talk to each other, and then if they got excited, we're supposed to see those increase.
But medically speaking, all that neuron chatter cannot be heard or seen through simple measures.
You don't want to do the spinal tap, right? That's very painful and then could be dangerous.
An MRI could successfully map the brain and regions affected by dementia and music, but those are costly and the noise from the machine could be distracting and skew results.
How can you put those people while they're praying or they're listening to the music into the functional MRI? That's almost impossible.
Sagaya says one of the main goals with this experiment is to hopefully see not only how music affects the brain, but also if certain kinds of music impact the brain differently. That's something he says researchers don't know.
Nobody knows yet, but after knowing those, maybe they start listening to those music more frequently in the daily life, and that prevent the progress of the disease.
To help with this study, Sagaya has enlisted his wife, Ayako Yonatane, a violinist who leads the Pegasus String Quartet. Yonatane has been teaching classical music at UCF for over 30 years.
Because I'm a performer, I don't really believe I have that much influence, you know, but I think the music itself has the power.
Yonatane will be playing classical music, but also some memorable classic pop songs too.
Beatles, ABBA, or those things. Not Swift Taylor's now, but because old people can sort of have a memory of those pieces.
Yonatane and the quartet played a few weeks ago in the first round of experimental trials for patients and heard that nonverbal patients were responding to the pop classics.
So when we did the concert, the first one, people start kind of like sort of moving around, moving their hand.
Sagaya, Yonatane, and all the researchers working on this project are hoping that these final two concerts glean even more insight into the impact of music on memory loss patients.
That story from Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pettersson. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, after all the noise about failing public schools in certain conversational corners, it's important to note that there are also inspiring success stories, and here is certainly one of those. Despite being one of the poorest counties in the state, the Glades County School District did the unthinkable and earned an A rating from the Florida Department of Education. The recognition follows years of planning and improvements to increase the county's facilities and create a learning environment that helps the students reach their full potential. WGCU's Eileen Kelly shares the resilient story of a school system on the rise.
I would double check that answer.
And I think part of being a successful district is you have to know where you are and be really truthful about what that data is saying.
And the data said Glades County was a failing school system. It has been this way for many, many years, but no longer. Dr. Alice Barfield grew up in rural Glades County and is a graduate of Moorhaven High School. She went into teaching and became an administrator in neighboring Lee County. But Barfield felt a calling to come back home, back to Glades County, a school district ranked 64th out of 67 Florida counties in academic achievement. Voters elected Barfield to right this failing school system. The position as superintendent of schools in Glades County was a cut in pay for Barfield.
Good job!
5 years later, Glades County was ranked as a grade A school.
You just have to take it for what it is. And so when we looked at the data, we needed to come up with a way to improve. I knew that it was not going to happen overnight, because when you are changing that type of doing transformation in schools, it takes many cycles to get on the right track. And so we did it in very small pieces.
Those pieces weren't always popular. For instance, Barfield said the district had employed too many uncertified teachers.
We put an emphasis on making sure that we were putting teachers that were certified into those classrooms. And so we started to see the first year that we got our scores back, we went up.
In 2020, the school district was ranked D. Under Barfield, the following year, it came up to a C.
We all considered that a win because it was improvement. Then we knew we had to focus more on things that would get our students to that next level.
Glades is a fiscally restrained county. The per capita income is $32,000, and close to one of every four children, those under the age of 18, lives in poverty.
Our district has very little budget when it comes to education. We're very blessed to have what we have. But one thing that we have that money can't buy is we have a lot of people that really always want to do what's best for students.
So the school district partnered with Florida Southwestern College in Fort Myers to offer college-level classes to the students in their high school. The college classes are of no charge, and this includes textbooks. The program is so popular that one-third of the high school's senior class are not only graduating, but they have earned an associate's degree without stepping foot on a college campus.
It's not just changing those students' lives, it's changing our community. Because if you look at the statistics in Florida, you see that, you know, Glades County has one of the highest poverty ratings. We have one of the highest unemployment ratings. Well, our school district is in charge of making sure that stops.
Barfield says she refuses to accept that poverty is synonymous with a poor school performance. That A rating is proof of that. This is the first time the school district has received an A in 14 years. This year, Glades was among 30 school districts to receive an A rating.
Our community needed this. They needed some really positive good news.
That was WGCU's Eileen Kelly reporting. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents, Sergina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tim Padgett, Sandra Victorova, Carrie Sheridan, Joe Mario Pedersen, and Eileen Kelly. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.